That is the sound you never want to hear. It is the sound of a warning siren going off at a nuclear power plant. But whether you can hear that sound or not, we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly news magazine keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from 1 mile away. So I know what happens when the experts get it wrong. Today's episode will be mostly dedicated to the big ongoing story of the week, the Fukushima power outage. Wanting to give you more than just the bad news, I contacted author, activist, nutritionist Kimberly Roberson to share information on how we can best preserve our health in the face of an ever-increasing onslaught of radiation. Her highly informative interview with practical steps we can and must take to protect ourselves will be coming up in just a few minutes. Today is Tuesday, March 19, 2013, and here is the week's nuclear news. Well, there's really only one story right now, and it's the ongoing power outage emergency at Fukushima. To recap and bring you up to date, yesterday, Monday, March 18, at 6:57 p.m. Japan time, the wreckage of the Fukushima nuclear power plant lost all power, which shut down all of its cooling systems. TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, did not report the outage until almost 3 hours later, at 10:11 p.m. Immediately at risk were the spent fuel pools containing about 2,100 radioactive fuel rods from the facility's number 1, 3, and 4 reactors. In addition, the common spent fuel pool containing 6,377 fuel rods lost all cooling, and part of a system that disposes of contaminated water was also shut down by the power blackout. TEPCO was receiving power from the local grid, but couldn't send it to the cooling systems at the spent fuel pools. Without crucial cooling, the heat generated by the radioactive fuel rods increased the temperature of the water, taking about 4 days to reach 65 degrees Celsius, above which there is danger of fire, explosion, and possible recriticality. According to former nuclear engineer Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education, crews probably have 4 to 5 days to restore power before pools reach levels beyond a controlled state known as cold shutdown, after which fire hoses can be used to continue the cooling. However, be aware that cold shutdown, as claimed by TEPCO and the Japanese government, is a misnomer. It was challenged by many as a public relations label when applied to the damaged, dangerously radioactive reactors in December of 2011. The fuel assemblies in the spent fuel pools are still extremely hot and will be for several years. If the pools were to heat up, a fire could occur with resulting radiation release. This is the case whenever any nuclear facility is taken offline and shut down, because shut down is not the same as decommissioned. As of today, Tuesday, March 19, TEPCO said it had restored the flow of cooling water to Unit 1 and 4 spent fuel pools affected by the blackout, but Unit 3 and the common fuel pool have remained without vital cooling systems for more than 24 hours. The company said its engineers were trying to repair a faulty switchboard that it blamed for the outage and that temperatures would remain at safe levels for at least 4 days, while claiming that the facility has backup systems. But to pick up on TEPCO spin speak, if there are backup systems, why aren't they working? If they worked, why would there have been a total power outage? Also, yes, the temperatures are still within safety limits. But the longer the facility remains without additional cooling water, the hotter each of these spent fuel pools will become. The temperature will not remain static. If it is not being cooled, it is getting hotter. This is another instance of TEPCO pretending the truth does not exist as long as they say it doesn't. Some experts have warned that the cooling system, many of which were hastily built by engineers frantically struggling to regain control of the overheating reactors, could be knocked out by another large earthquake. This, of course, is what we've all been fearing. watching Japan closely every time an earthquake or aftershock took place in the northeastern part of the country. Instead, we have this exact same nightmare situation, courtesy some problem with a faulty switchboard in the TEPCO electrical system. A company spokesman told reporters, Fukushima Daiichi still runs on makeshift equipment. This is supposed to make us feel better, he added. Considering the equipment situation, we may be pushing a little too hard. I don't even know what that means. This spokesman went on to look into the TEPCO crystal ball and predict that cooling would, quote-unquote, soon be restored at a third pool, though the fourth might take until Wednesday, meaning day three in a four-day timeline. At risk is the potential for a radiation release far larger and more lethal than the original incident of March of 2011. To give you an idea of the scale of this, several experts at last week's symposium on the medical and ecological consequences of Fukushima, Hiroaki Koide, Master of Nuclear Engineering from Kyoto University, and Akio Matsumura, founder of the Global Forum of Spiritual and Parliamentary Leaders, both said that the amount of radiation released at Fukushima to date equaled 168 Hiroshima nuclear bombs. The fix on the first two units is nowhere near as solid as TEPCO would want us to believe. According to Lucas Hickson of Informable, workers were unable to determine what caused the switchboards to stop functioning, as no visible damage was found. They later repaired two of the boards, but are currently using an emergency power generator to restore cooling for the Unit 4 spent fuel pool, the one balanced atop the precarious remains of the reactor building, while the Unit 3 spent fuel pool and common fuel pool are still not restored. Mary Olson of Nuclear Information and Resource Service gave a close read to the articles on this new twist in the ongoing Fukushima disaster, specifically the article written by Bloomberg this morning, and she pointed out, TEPCO is still pasting this thing together with what I call effectively paper clips and duct tape. One of the four is on power, one is on diesel, that's the backup generator, and two others were, at the time of this writing, which was 1 p.m. Eastern Time today, planned to be reconnected to main power. But if they don't know what the problem is, there is no guarantee that the system will support it. She went on, I'm not saying I know anything different from here. I just think that the level of numb your mind because it sounds so palatable and contradiction within the text of one article is pretty high. So Nuclear Hot Seat suggests that we all continue to monitor enenews.com for further article links while protecting our health in ways that will be addressed later in today's podcast. On to other news. The Helen Caldicott Foundation Symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine on the medical and ecological consequences of the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe was a resounding success. The event, marking the two-year anniversary of the beginning of the Fukushima disaster, was co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. Caldicott Foundation Executive Director Molly Lightfoot has reported that in addition to the hundreds of people who attended the symposium in person, more than 4,300 people in 650 cities worldwide watched the event online via live stream. The Helen Caldicott Foundation will make the recording of the event, including the presenters' PowerPoints, available at its Nuclear Free Planet website. In the meantime, links to available video recordings will be posted on the Nuclear Hot Seat website, nuclearhotseat.com/blog. A bit of good news which arrived on the anniversary of Fukushima. On March 11, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission commissioners upheld last summer's licensing board denial of a construction operating license for the proposed Calvert Cliffs 3 nuclear reactor in Maryland. This decision marks the first time in history that NRC commissioners have upheld the denial of a license for a commercial nuclear reactor. Woohoo! The commissioners denied Unistar Nuclear's request for a review of a decision last summer by the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, which found that the project would be in violation of the Atomic Energy Act, which prohibits foreign ownership, control, or domination of a U.S. nuclear reactor. Unistar Nuclear is wholly owned by Electricité de France, EDF, which itself is 85% owned by the government of France. Michael Marriott, executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, NIRS, said, "On this second anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, the NRC commissioners have provided the public with a rare bit of good news." NIRS brought the foreign ownership issue as a contention to the ASLB in November of 2008, along with partner interveners Public Citizen, Beyond Nuclear, and Southern Maryland Cares. Marriott added, "Of course, the commissioners really had no choice. The Atomic Energy Act is clear. Foreign ownership of U.S. nuclear reactors is illegal." End quote. So in other words, the NRC was just following the law. What a concept. Last week, the Maryland legislature approved Governor O'Malley's bill to jumpstart offshore wind power in the state. With this declaration, according to Michael Marriott, Maryland's future is clear. It will be based on clean, renewable power, not dirty, dangerous, and expensive nuclear reactors. Congratulations to everyone who was involved in that. Here's some not-so-good news. Southern California Edison, the operators of the dangerously damaged and shut-down San Onofre nuclear power plant, are fighting tooth and nail to put one of their cash cow nuclear reactors back online, perhaps in part to pay the $1.8 million salary and perks of Pete Dietrich, their official in charge of nuclear matters. That salary figure was revealed last week. First, SCE proposed that they run the nuclear power plant at 70% power for 5 months just to see what would happen. Isn't that reassuring? Now they want to restart at full power. Even if San Onofre could be restarted safely and run at full power, the risk of a breakdown would increase to what is being labeled as vexing levels. What comforting language, vexing. I would say horrifying levels after months. This in a report that was concluded this past Monday. The report projected that even at 70% power, the risk of a tube break would increase to an unacceptable level after about a year and a half. Those calculations were based on conditions in its sister unit, number 3, where tube damage was more extensive. According to Daniel Hirsch, a lecturer on nuclear policy at the University of California, Santa Cruz, if it were safe, they wouldn't have to twist logic into a pretzel to try to claim they can run at 100% power after a year of claiming they can't. Nuclear engineer John Large, a consultant for Friends of the Earth, said the report amounted to a prediction that, quote, "the plant will progressively destroy itself." Large, who is a London-based nuclear engineer, said, "If the Intertek analysis is correct, the plant only has a remaining total service life of 1 year at full power or 16 months at 70% power. After this, I doubt if any option will exist for Edison to repair the plant's steam generators because the problem lies deep within the tube bundle, being essentially inaccessible by humans or machines." Speaking as someone who lives in Southern California, it's also a really, 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 really bad idea to restart these under any circumstances. Another piece of bad news, this one shocking. This past weekend, June Horry, an NHK announcer and journalist who has been in Southern California at UCLA for the past year and has closely followed the San Onofre protests, nuclear regulatory meetings, and other actions and events, was supposed to be screening a documentary that he made while he was here. It covers San Onofre, the long-hidden nuclear accident at the Santa Susana Field Laboratory 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles, and, of course, Fukushima. Well, that screening did not happen. June was forbidden to screen it by his employer. He has been taken out of journalist by NHK, and when he returns to Japan, will be hosting a cooking show called Today's Cooking. He is a newlywed, so quitting his job is not an option. So June and his reportedly excellent documentary have been muzzled. Japan dropped from number 22 to number 58 on the Freedom of Press list last year. Based on this incident, it is obviously going to plummet even further this year. Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party has removed most anti-nuclear researchers from a revamped post-Fukushima energy policy advisory board to the government. 6 of 8 board members who voted for phasing out nuclear power and advised the previous government to do so have been dropped from the LDP panel. Another 10 members were reappointed, including Akio Mimura, an advisor for Nippon Steel and Sumitomo Metal Corporation, as chairman. Mimura headed an energy advisory board under a previous LDP government that promoted nuclear power. Nothing like reinforcing your bias. Out of France, we have our numbnuts of the week. Catastrophic nuclear accidents like Chernobyl in 1986 or Fukushima in 2011 or, heaven forbid, right now, we're told are very rare and their probability of occurring infinitesimal, tiny, small, wee, wee, wee. But when they occur, they get costly. That's why the French government, when it came up with cost estimates for an accident in France, kept them secret for 6 years. This report has been leaked to the French magazine Le Journal des Dimanches. Turns out, the upper end of the cost spectrum of the accident at a nuclear power plant at Dampierre in the department of Loire in north-central France amounted to over 3 times the country's gross domestic product. No wonder they kept it secret. The study was done in 2007 for the Institute for Radiological Protection and Nuclear Safety, a government agency with over 1,700 employees. This is France's public service expert in nuclear and radiation risks, so it isn't the report of some overambitious, publicity-seeking think tank. The actual estimate was 5.8 trillion euros, so large that France could not possibly deal with it. So 3 weeks ago, in response to the leakage of this report, the Institute released a more politically correct report for public consumption that pegged the cost of the accident at a mere 430 billion euros. This is what nuclear political toadies do the world over. They game the numbers, tra-la, tra-la. Right, like that's going to make any difference if something goes wrong. Given the crucial nature of the not-yet-resolved Fukushima power outage crisis, I thought it important to include information in this week's Nuclear Hot Seat on how to protect and preserve our health. Because of the increasing levels of radiation we face, potentially at catastrophic levels, we all need to be paying attention. For this crucial information, I turned to the reigning expert in our community with gratitude for making herself available on such short notice. Kimberly Roberson is a certified diet counselor and nutrition educator who has served on the board of the National Association of Nutrition Professionals. She has worked at Sane Freeze, CalPERG, and Greenpeace USA. She has lobbied for environmental and natural health issues on the state and federal level, as well as the Food and Drug Administration. Kimberly is the founder of Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, more about that later, and her first book is Silence Deafening Fukushima Fallout, A Mother's Response. Before we get started, I need to add a disclaimer that the information that is being shared in this interview is for information purposes only and is not meant to diagnose any disease or prescribe any treatment. For that, you need to check with your medical practitioner of choice. There, I have made my lawyer happy. Kimberly Roberson, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in health in the way that you did.
Well, for several years, I was dealing with rheumatoid arthritis, and I was looking for a way to be healthier, live a healthier life. I had this wonderful opportunity to live and work on an organic farm in Northern California, and I learned a lot about relaxing, taking deep breaths, figuring out how to make my immune system more healthy. And that led to a real passion for natural health. And I went back to school and I studied and started working in the field. And I would see all different types of people dealing with all different kinds of immune issues or just regular health issues, some for weight loss, but a real host of different things. And at the same time, as kind of luck would have it, I got a great opportunity to start learning more about chemical dependency and eating disorder recovery. And I studied under a really wonderful woman named Victoria Green. And I worked at the Henry Olaf clinics in the Bay Area and also Bayside Marin. I worked at Mount St. Joseph St. Elizabeth Hospital. I worked for a while at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic giving talks to young mothers. And my clientele, you know, a typical day would involve working with young mothers in halfway houses so that they could reunite with their families, teaching them good nutrition practices. Then I would go over to Marin County, and I worked in an inpatient facility with a minimum of $30,000 for a month is what people would pay to be there. So one thing I learned is that people from all walks of life, rich and poor, you know, it really reinforced for me how we have many of the same problems, the same, obviously the same DNA, the same fears, and definitely the need to nourish ourselves on a mind-body-spirit level.
Tell us a little bit more about this mind-body-spirit orientation that you do have to health maintenance.
Food is one of the things that nourishes us. We're nourished by many things, and I think having a spiritual practice, even if it means believing in something bigger than ourselves, definitely helps to nourish our bodies. Our thoughts create our realities, and that's a big piece of it. We could eat very, very healthfully, but if we're not getting proper exercise, if we're not breathing the cleanest air we can get by way of using good air filters, for instance, practicing good health habits on a number of different levels every day, then we're really not giving our bodies the best chance to be healthy, especially in these really challenging times that we're living in.
Given the exposure that we are having in ever-increasing amounts to radiation, how does your philosophy relate to what we need to be doing to protect ourselves, to stave off as best we can the worst of the impact from radiation on our lives?
Well, to understand that we're in this for the long haul. Sometimes we have scares, you know, like what is happening at Fukushima Daiichi right now. Some days are better than others with how we hear the news and what news is getting out. So it tends to really kind of keep us on a stressed level. You know, our adrenals are depleted when we get overstressed, and we might forget to eat or drink the things that really nourish our bodies. So I've come to this philosophy for myself that understanding that we're in it for the long haul, understanding that the way that we think about this and approach this is very important. It could be easy to fall into a sense of disordered eating if we're not careful and being afraid to eat many things that we used to eat before. And that's something that's a challenge, but that we have to be careful about, because food is still something that we primarily rely on to nourish our bodies. Food, healthy air, healthy water, exercise. These are all real basics. And then, you know, having a good spiritual practice definitely helps. Not everybody does, but I've found that it definitely helps, and the people that I've worked with and who do have one tend to be happier people. So just having an underlying sense of positive thinking and then understanding there are some physiological things that are very important to address. I mean, we could talk about the healthy liver function, for instance. There are basic things people can do to keep their body in the best possible condition.
Why don't we go there and talk about some of the practical things that people might do on a daily basis that will allow them to improve their health or perhaps be able to resist the impact of the ever-increasing amounts of radiation that we're subjected to?
And some of them are simpler than you would think. You know, for instance, starting the day not with a cup of coffee right in front of the laptop, looking up the news of the day, realizing that the news is the worst news that is compiled from all over the world that we can get on our internet if we choose that for our screen. That's the first thing we see in the morning.
Oh, you've been onto my Facebook site.
Really important, though, if we're in this for the long haul, to take 10 or 15 minutes to center, to meditate, to take a walk, and to start the day thinking something positive. That will set the course for the entire day.
Now, let's hit the pause button on that, because how does that relate, or does it relate, to what they're saying in Japan, which is, oh, radiation can't hurt you, and just don't worry, be happy, and keep a smile on your face, and nothing bad will happen to you?
That's a very interesting question, because our immune response to stress is so significant. There may be something to it to people here in the United States. I wouldn't say Japan, but maybe not taking quite as many precautionary measures, but not being all wrapped up in the stress is a good thing. We have to find a healthy balance within our lives. We have to be proactive and we have to be educated, but we can't allow it to consume our thoughts, because that leads to lack of sleep, that leads to depression, anxiety, all things that really work to counter healthy habits and work to suppress our immune system.
So we need to regularly work into our lives realistic ways to de-stress. And that doesn't necessarily mean sitting and eating potato chips on the couch watching reality TV, but doing something that nourishes us and allows us to release the negative impact of the stress that comes from so much of this information.
Very true. And I might add that I'm certified in nutrition. I didn't take the more allopathic route of registered dietitian for the very reason that we are not compartmentalized. You know, we're made up of many, many different parts. We're the sum of many parts. And so it's very important to look at our lives in a whole way, in a holistic way. And if you have the money, you can go to a yoga class once a week or twice. Very, very important. Or to find a beautiful place to take a walk, or when we have our meditation, to remember a beautiful place that we were at, and that's where we want to return. I don't think human beings were built to, you know, the people that are working, I'm speaking right now to the people in the activist community who have to deal with this day upon day because they're fighting a good fight. There can be so much darkness involved that it's really hard to keep the light in, but we have to find it and maintain that area in our lives. It's extremely important.
What are some of the physical things we can do to support our body while we are seeking ways to spiritually and emotionally de-stress from all the negative information that we are dealing with?
Great question. And there are some very basic habits that we do every day. They have really significant impact on our lives. And some of them sound very simple, and thankfully they are. A good multivitamin and mineral supplement is extremely important for many reasons. The reason why I just recommend a multi right off the bat is because we have enough other things to think about without going and taking everyone individually and trying to figure out what will work best for us. So there are some excellent brands on the market. You need the minerals. That's important, not just the vitamins, but the minerals, because the minerals, if we have sufficient levels, are what will help to block some of these harmful radio isotopes that are in our environment, not just from Fukushima, mind you. We have, of course, the above-ground bomb testing from even the 50s and 60s that has still impacted our environment, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and then we have electromagnetic fields. So,
and every nuclear reactor that's out there leaks.
Not absolutely, every nuclear reactor. So this is a really significant issue, but just taking good multivitamin and mineral supplement and then mindfully choosing what we buy, because, you know, if you look at the label of some of these multivitamin and mineral supplements, it can be very misleading and ironic in some ways. If we think that, oh, omega-3s from tuna, wow, that would be really good. But that's the pre-Fukushima thinking. Now that our ocean, the Pacific Ocean, has been so impacted by Fukushima, I would not want to take fish oil from the North Pacific. And, you know, I was just at the aquarium in San Francisco over the weekend, and they had a big chart on the wall that, you know, reminded me, you know, scientists don't believe, they don't think that we have several different oceans. There's one ocean with many ocean basins. And what happened in the Pacific and is continuing to happen with Fukushima will impact every ocean in our world. So let's re-examine what we consume from the oceans until we get good food and supplement monitoring and testing, which we so desperately need. So I've decided to eliminate some foods for the time being. And I don't think of this as disordered thinking. I think of this as making informed choices. And if you look at the back of some of the health food store multivitamins, even for children, you will find that iodine, potassium iodide, is being sourced from kelp, which we now know, because of Fukushima, here in California has been contaminated with significant levels of iodine-131. So, and that's the only thing that they've tested for. The scientists doing that study have gone back to find more funding so that they can test for longer-lived cesium-134 and 137, which they most certainly will find because these radionuclides, I mean, there are hundreds involved in nuclear power accidents. We hear a lot about iodine-131, half-life of 8 days. There's iodine-129, half-life of 17 million years.
And, of course, half-life only refers to the period of time during which it becomes half as lethal as it was. And in talking with a nuclear engineer way back right after Fukushima, he said, no, if you want to know what the active time period is for radiation to be present and dangerous in any substance, it's half-life times a minimum of 10 half-life cycles, or with something like plutonium, it's as many as 20 half-life cycles. So you multiply the number by a factor of 10 or 20, and it's much longer than it originally appears.
Exactly. And we even have to change our language. You know, it's, okay, cesium-137 half-life of 30 years. Hazardous for over 100. We should start talking hazardous. Absolutely. And, you know, back to what we can do, it's what we can add to our diets and lifestyles and also what we can take away. You know, liver function is so important to human health. Our liver does over 500 different jobs. Most people are very surprised to know that. But if your liver is toxic and overburdened, everything else in your body will slow, and then disease, you know, illness can set in. I like to think of it like a vase of water. You know, imagine the toxins in your body building up, and then when the water spills over, that's when the disease sets in. So you want to keep that toxic burden down as much as possible.
How does one do that?
Things like avoiding sugar in the diet, avoiding, you know, Americans, I think, on average, eat 125 pounds of sugar a year, and that's everything that you can imagine, from putting it in the coffee to salad dressing and ketchup and hidden things that you wouldn't think. So
there's even sugar in some commercial salt that's out there.
It's incredible. Wow, I didn't know that. I didn't, but there you go. So really cutting down on sugar. Stevia Plus is made from a plant source, but it also has inulin, which helps to stabilize blood sugar. Avoiding fatty foods, excess alcohol, a glass of wine every now and then is healthy. Red wine, for the most part, it's been believed to be healthful, but alcohol consumption on a daily basis is not. Coffee has also been found to be challenging for the liver, because especially if it's commercially grown coffee that has a number of toxic pesticides, you're going to have a hard time clearing the liver to do the other jobs if that's something that you're ingesting on a daily basis. So switching to tea is much better, although I would not recommend green tea right now, because the Fukushima prefecture in northern Japan area is one of the largest producers of tea in the world, and it's being exported. Some of it is still getting out of the country. So
I think it's so important now for us to check labels for country of origin. I even find suspicion about sea salt, because where was the sea salt harvested? Which sea?
Mm-hmm, right. Or is it somewhere in a desert in Utah? You don't know. And that's why it's really great to just take a few minutes every week and call companies, call the 800 number, and find out where they're sourcing certain things. You can come up with lots of great information that way. And until we get food monitoring and testing on a broad level, we need to depend on our own resources to do that. Some of the other things for healthy immune function is to get good exercise, and just to eat as many foods lower on the food chain as possible, because the more digestible and least fatty the food is, the easier it is on your liver. So your liver can do all of the other things it needs to do rather than trying to clean your system of chemical additives that you don't need also. That's another big one.
Now, when we were preparing for this interview, you talked about the need for intestinal fortitude, which is not just guts, but it's gut. Could you explain about that?
Well, intestinal fortitude as an attitude that we are in it for the long haul, and our habits every day become a much bigger part of our lives. I think also realizing that the GI tract, I think close to 90%, I've heard it anywhere between 85 to 90% of our immune system is housed in our intestinal tract. And back when I was studying nutrition, this information just, you know, blew me away, because it goes back to what we think, our thoughts creating our health to a large degree. I mean, I don't think it's right, rather, to tell someone that they have cancer that, oh, you thought yourself into that process. Of course not. But the way that we feel about our world around us and our thinking does have an impact on our own health. So, you know, we've heard these sayings, she died of a broken heart, or he worried himself to death, or things like that. They came from somewhere. You know, people found over the centuries that these things can happen if people are unhappy. So there's the mind-body approach of your immune system gets the signal. Your immune system is in your GI tract, right? These cells that have receptor sites that directly communicate to cells in your brain. So you think a certain way, and you're going to have a mind-gut connection. So one of the ways is positive thinking and the meditation and the relaxation, the things we talked about, but also probiotics are a great way to help kind of load in this healthy bacteria into your GI tract. And it's one of the things I found working a lot with nutritional supplements, that this isn't something that you necessarily need to take every day. So taking a probiotic three, four times a week is good. Some people like to take them a few times a week. Another one is a good digestive enzyme that will have not just, like, for instance, there's a brand out there called Beano, and I think there's just one enzyme in there to break down carbohydrate, but a good full-spectrum digestive enzyme will break down lipids and carbohydrates and milk, a whole variety. So a broad-spectrum digestive enzyme.
Now, you're planning on having, on providing consultations for people based on your areas of expertise. Is that set up yet? And if it's not, when will it be?
Well, I'm hoping for this summer. I've been doing a lot of work. My son is not yet in kindergarten, so I have him home during the day. So I'm a little limited right now with some of the things I can do, but hopefully this summer I'll be back to taking consultations. If people out there listening, if anyone has like real extreme concerns right now about what they're eating or not being able to make those choices, please feel free to contact me. My website is silencedeafening.com, and you can just log on there and you can leave me a message. This wasn't something I was planning on doing. Honestly, when I left working on nuclear issues and then I studied nutrition and then I became a stay-at-home mom, I was ready to just kind of go into this mommy bubble and not emerge for many years. I really wanted that. And then Fukushima happened, and I realized that's not possible, because part of what it takes to be a good parent, a good auntie and uncle and grandparent and cousin involves being aware of what's happening in our world, and it doesn't just stop at our front door. So that's why I'm not set up right now to start taking consultations, but I will be soon, and I'm really starting to look forward to it because I'm realizing that there's more of a need than ever.
You founded the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network. Now, I'm going to do a future interview with you and perhaps one or two other members of the group to get very specific about it. But briefly, could you tell people about what the group is and where it focuses?
Well, Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network is a coalition of groups that have been tracking what's been happening at Fukushima Daiichi for the past year and a half. We sort of sprung up around a food monitoring petition that I wrote on April 1st of 2011, where, like many people listening, I was so shocked at what was happening and the lack of information coming out that I found change.org, started a petition, and then that kind of served as a foundation to organize around. And then I was so blessed to reconnect with people that I'd worked with many years ago, like Nuclear Information Resource Service, and Citizens for Health, and of course Ecological Options Network, a great group too, and also Beyond Nuclear, who I hadn't worked with in the past, but many people are familiar with Cindy Folkers on her work on radiation health with this issue. She just gave a great presentation at the Helen Caldicott Symposium. And we also have some wonderful women working with us. Some of them have come over from Japan. They are married to Japanese men. They're American, and they came back over. They had to evacuate, and they were horrified to learn that the United States level that the FDA has set for cesium-134-37 is 12 times higher for consumption than it is in Japan. And so this has been very important for FAN with the work that we're doing now, which is we're very focused on a petition that we filed with the FDA back on March 12th, asking for a significant reduction in cesium-134 and 137. And as Cindy Folkers mentions in her presentation, this is a good place to start. By no means is it everything, but it's a place to start. Currently, the United States has a recommendation of 1,200 becquerel per kilogram.
Japan allows a level of 100, which is high anyway, and the United States allows 1,200, which means that food that is illegal to sell in Japan is perfectly legal to export from Japan to the United States, and there's nobody standing in between giving us a readout on what the radiation level is and how we might want to, like, avoid that stuff.
Yep, it's just insane. Oranges and pistachios from California were found to exceed Japan's allowable level of 100 becquerel per kilogram. And Japan also has lower levels for baby food. So this is absolutely atrocious. It's something that FAN is very focused on continuing our work with. The people who have signed on to our petition so far are Ecological Options Network, Beyond Nuclear, and Citizens for Health. And more groups, as we, you know, kind of finesse the details and communicate to people and different groups, more will be signing on. I'm very pleased that the nearly 6,000 signatures that came from that first food monitoring petition that I started will be attached to this FDA petition. And we have scientific data that's being worked into the whole process. And the process itself will take several months when you file with FDA. The good news is that they have to respond, but the not-so-good news is it takes quite a while to hear back from them sometimes.
Well, we will follow up with Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network and keep track of the work that you're doing and give you another opportunity to come out of Nuclear Hot Seat and explain further what the group is about. But I would be remiss in this interview if I did not mention your excellent, highly readable book, Silence Deafening, Fukushima Fallout, A Mother's Response. In it, you use a very gentle, very narrative voice to walk people through some of this health-preserving information. And I find that it's an excellent book not only for the quality of the information, but the gentleness with which it is revealed. It's something that newbies to this issue can actually read and wrap their heads around without freaking out, which so often is the danger with some of the books that we have out there. What moved you to write this book?
Well, it was one of those things. I never planned to do it, but people supported me along the way. I was asked by Molly Lightfoot with Helen Caldicott Foundation to write an essay for their website about the petition. And then I believe you saw it online and you thought it would make a good ebook. And then someone else saw it and said, we would really like to see this in print. So thank you so much for your support, Libby. And one thing after another happened, and we just had our second edition launch last week, so there's a revised and expanded edition. It's a slender volume. It's something that you could read in a day or a couple of evenings, or some people might even read it in one. And I've been told that people have picked it up and read it straight through. Some of the people that we're working with found the book and then found FAN through the book, which has been really so gratifying. And this is the kind of book that you can hand your cousin or the grandpa who's always countering on everything you have to say, or your really conservative friend, and say, take a look at this. You know, this is a concerned mother. And they'll probably find that they have a lot of the same concerns. And the other thing I really hope to accomplish with the book was to give people a way to feel empowered. It's not just enough to learn about the issue, but we have to speak out as much as possible, as loudly and as clearly as we can, in order to counter these really complex problems that we're dealing with.
If people wish to reach you, Kim, how might they do so?
The website is silencedeafening.com, and there is a tab to Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network on the website. You can also email me directly at kim@silencedeafening.com. or fan@sonic.net, and that's fan@sonic.net.
Kimberly Roberson, thank you so much for all you do, and especially for being my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Kimberly Roberson of the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, also the author of Silence Deafening, Fukushima Fallout, A Mother's Response. I always want to say a mother's revenge. Kim wanted you to know that if you go to silencedeafening.com and click on the Read button, you will be able to access the first two chapters of her book and read it for free. I think you will find it of interest. We will also post all of her links on our website, www.nuclearhotseat.com. Click on the blog page. Here's the final thought for this week. In last week's podcast, I said it was too soon after the symposium put on by Dr. Helen Caldicott and Physicians for Social Responsibility to know its ultimate impact. To be honest, it was devastating. In 2 days, we learned the cutting-edge information about the Fukushima disaster, low-level radiation damage to the human body, the inhumanity of our own government towards its radiation-exposed naval personnel, Chernobyl birth defects, so much it's almost impossible to contemplate. I know I'm not the only one who left there exhausted, sick, and depressed. I joked beforehand that I'd probably spend my flight home curled fetal in my seat. It wasn't that far from the truth. Once I got home, I spent 3.5 days in bed watching reruns of Project Runway before I could face more than the most cursory of Facebook posts dealing with nuclear. And then, the Fukushima power blackout. The problem with being in this movement is that when we get news like that, we know exactly what it means. How to cope? I agree with Kim Roberson that having a spiritual practice is essential for those of us in the movement, be it standard religion, earth-based Native American First Nations-based, meditation, or 12-step. We need to pay close attention to our health and find holistic ways to keep our bodies strong and healthy. What's missing, and what ultimately helped lift me out of my physical, mental, spiritual depression after the symposium, is some kind of support network to help pull us out of the darkness that we sometimes slip into from the information that we find. One of my favorite questions to ask interviewees, especially those who have been in this movement for a long time, is, what do you do when it all feels like too much? How do you keep yourself going? Consistently, the answers I've received are, be with those you love. Connect with something more than just yourself. Spend time in nature. Turn your depression into anger and turn your anger into action. All of those are terrific suggestions. We deal with some of the most horrible information on the planet. As we build our international community of activists, as we align with other planet-defending, life-defending movements to move all of us towards nuclear sanity and energy sanity, let's take care of ourselves. Let's take care of each other. If you're in a dark place, pick up the phone, call, write, reach out. Don't be afraid to ask for help and support when you slip on the cosmic banana peel that is nuclear. Pledge to be there for yourself and for each other. And if life, sweet life, truly is on the way out, I, for one, plan to go out fighting with everything I've got. I invite you to join me. Before we close, an update on Dr. Catherine Euler, who I interviewed on Nuclear Hot Seat on February 5th. She was sentenced as one of the LANL 6 for blockading the Los Alamos nuclear laboratory on the anniversary of Hiroshima. She was given the option of community service, which is the option that she took. Her horrible, terrible punishment? Working on an annotated bibliography about Canyon Uranium Mine and other uranium mining at the Grand Canyon for NEARS. Mary Olson, who spoke so eloquently on gender issues at the symposium and who was quoted earlier in the podcast, is supervising her community service. Sometimes, you know, justice really is served. In closing, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 19, 2013. Material for this podcast has been gathered from the ever-reliable ENENews.com, Beyond Nuclear, Nuclear Information and Resource Service, NEARS, and Formable.com, and the fabulous Lucas Hickson, who I had the honor and privilege of meeting at the symposium last week, the Associated Press, Fox 5 News in San Diego, SanOnofreSafety.org, Bloomberg, TestosteronePit.com, that's a new one, NuclearNews.net, NewYorkTimes.com, and the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook Network, with a special shout-out to Fukushima sleuth extraordinaire Ray Marsalis. You can find all our podcasts posted on the NuclearHotSeat.com/blog page, and you can get the entire library on iTunes podcasts. Friend me, friend Nuclear Hot Seat, friend Nuclear Hot Seat group. You've got three options. This on Facebook. You can share us. You can link to us. Send a link to this podcast to your personal list, friends, and family. Nuclear Hot Seat is the activist voice on nuclear issues, so use us as the resource we are. If you happen to want to donate to us, that's appreciated too. There's a donate button on the homepage of the website. And if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, don't go back to sleep. And hopefully, we'll all be together again next week.